Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, what a week. What started with a record drop in the pound in the early hours of Monday morning moved on to bond yields spiralling, mortgage deals pulled left, right and centre, and the Bank of England forced to step in to protect pension funds. Is the UK economy in crisis? Again, how much is the Chancellor's mini-budget to blame? What can the government do now? Anything? Or are we all going to hell in a handcart? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, well, when we gave our debrief last week, Simon Lee, on what we made of the Chancellor's mini budget, did we see any of this coming? In this episode, we're going to break down what all this means and then tell you what on earth you can do about it to protect your cash. But first, Simon, in a nutshell, if you can, a rather large nutshell, I would imagine. Just give us a rundown of what's been going on.
Well, I don't think we quite expected the full-scale lurch from inflation-beaten, struggling economy to full-on mini financial crisis that we've seen over the past week. But I suppose you could have mapped out the path if you wanted to last Friday. I think a lot of us thought the reaction last Friday to the mini-budget would maybe peter out over the weekend and the start of this week, but instead it escalated. Markets decided that they didn't like the look of the debt-funded tax cuts and the unfunded big spending that the Chancellor was laying out. But I don't think that necessarily it was that and the going for growth plan alone that did it, because it could be that this is the right concept, this is the right route to take. I think this was the culmination of a series of events, and it showed a real lack of judgment in the way that it was delivered. So it came off the back of the Bank of England raising interest rates by 0.5 percentage points on Thursday, which the Fed had raised interest rates over there by 0.75 percentage points a day before. So we'd fallen even further behind the Fed. I mean, we've got base rate up to 2.25%. The Fed's on, you know, 3 to 3.25. So they are above us. This is increasing the problem of the dollar's strength. The dollar's strength is a problem for economies all around the world. As we explained last week on the podcast, what happens is people go looking for risk-free rate of return, government bonds, which are seen as the safest asset from governments that aren't going to default on them. And if you can get a higher rate of return on those US bonds than you will do on UK gilts, which are UK government bonds, then you are going to park your money in the US, particularly if you see the US as having a stronger economy and better prospects than you do the UK, for example. And particularly if you think that the pound is going to continue to depreciate against the dollar, because the money you put into those UK bonds, you're going to get pounds back, and those pounds are going to be worth less than they would be when you put them in there due to the depreciation. So there is already that issue going on. I think that whilst it may be the case that Kwasi Kwarteng's going for growth ideas are the right kind of thing to shake Britain out of its post-financial crisis rut, as I said, it was the delivery. To announce that kind of bombardment, and it was a bombardment last Friday morning, of tax cutting and spending outside of a budget, but not even just outside of a budget, outside of an autumn or spring statement, was highly unorthodox, because it doesn't come with the same treasury costings, etc., and it doesn't come within the framework that we expect things to be done. And that framework exists for a reason. Okay, it exists to make people think, right, we're serious about this, we've got our rules, we're following our rules, whatever we do it within that framework. Now, you can come up with different ideas, but it's really quite a good idea to present those ideas within the sort of known area for presenting them, and that wasn't happening. So it was funded with debt, and it also came with no Office of Budget Responsibility report alongside it. That was a major concern. And I think it was foolish to do that. If you put that alongside the problems I just talked about, inflation, the fact that actually I think there's an issue with confidence in the Bank of England as well. I think the Bank of England's modelled thinking over the past year to 18 months bears some of the responsibility here. And then you've also even got the fact that the Chancellor stood up and when he delivered his fiscal event, he stood up and said that the Bank of England's independence was sacrosanct. Well, why are you saying that? I mean, why would you need to say that? That doesn't normally need to be said when someone's delivering a budget, mini budget, or any other similar thing in Parliament. So, because there were questions already being asked about it. And all of this has added up to, you know, the bold plans massively backfiring. I think investors took fright, and what we did is we perhaps reached the limit of what markets would accept in terms of us issuing new debt to fund our plans without really explaining what the plan was involved in that. And so what happened was the immediate reaction is the pound fell. The pound then dropped substantially overnight, Sunday to Monday, hit a low of 103. And everybody was very much worried about the pound. People focused on the pound, but it's gilt yields that were the problem, the rising cost of government borrowing. And costs were spiraling upwards. Costs have been rising over the course of this year, but it's accelerated over the summer and it dramatically accelerated after Friday. And we then saw chaos in the mortgage markets because whilst the two are not directly related, they are interlinked. Lenders started to pull mortgages at a rapid rate, reprice deals. Rates had already gone up substantially. You saw panic there. But also behind all of that, we were seeing problems with pension funds, which have got themselves involved in these complex derivative-based investments and were facing cash calls on them. So the pension funds are fine. The pension funds are solvent. The pension funds can meet their responsibilities to the defined benefit pension holders that they owe the money to for the rest of their lives in that commitment. The problem was that they were having cash calls made on them by these funds and they didn't have the cash, the liquidity to meet these cash calls. So basically it's saying, right, under the contract that you have got with us for this investment, if prices fall below a certain amount, you need to give us some more money. When people talk about collateral, right? Okay, you need to give us some more money. The pension funds don't have that money to hand over. So in order to get that money to hand over, they were having to sell the long-dated gilts that they hold, 30-year gilts, which adds more pressure to the downward price pressure on the gilts, which then creates a vicious circle. And that's the dysfunction that the Bank of England was talking about in particular yesterday and why it has now gone on this bond buying program. I mean, it's very easy to get caught up in hyperbole here, but we have managed to shoot ourselves in the foot so badly that we have triggered our own mini financial crisis. I'm not saying this is like the financial crisis, but we have triggered our own mini financial crisis. Crashing pound, rocketing gilt yields, fears of pension fund collapse, mortgage chaos. It's not the reaction you'd want for your bold new plans for the economy. And there's been there has been an attempt to shift the blame to the Bank of England, to speculators, to all these other things. But I think that you can make a very strong case for the argument that this would not have happened without Friday's events and if that had been done differently. Nonetheless, like the old joke about asking for directions, well, I wouldn't start from here, you know, well, I wouldn't start from here. But the question is, what do we do about it now? Because all that stuff is done, right? Can't take it back. It's all done.
Yeah, someone likened it to putting the pin back in the grenade. It's a little bit late for that. I also called it kamikaze economics. Lee Boyce, I keep thinking back on the statement and wondering, was there something perhaps that they could have left out? The statement, the fiscal event, whatever we want to call it, the mini, not mini budget, that would have made a difference. The IMF, of course, coming out, forgot to mention them earlier, saying that the additional rate tax abandonment, I guess, was a really big thing. Had they left that out, which I understand it was a bit of a last minute decision to put it in, everything would be a little bit better? Or was it just sort of, as Simon saying, it's a little bit of everything?
It's more government borrowing on government borrowing on government borrowing. And it's kind of getting to the point where it's how big can the pile go? And I think the lack of costings to the OBR, you know, report, as Simon says, coming out of the blue, as it were, I mean, it caught everyone by surprise. And I understand that it's a new government, it's a newly formed government that is trying to stamp their mark probably within about an 18-month time frame. It's not very long to get this into action. And so they've decided to go big and hard and fast, you know, very, very, very quickly. And it's just caught everyone by surprise. And that is what, you know, that kind of instability is just not ideal. And that's why we're now in a circumstance that we're saying that could we have forecast this was going to happen when we were chatting on Friday? Well, no, not really. But it's at the moment, it is just financial news after financial news, isn't it? I mean, rate rise on a Thursday, mini budget on a Friday, pound crashing on a Monday, you know, mini financial crisis triggered on a Tuesday. It's just... Yeah, it's absolutely mind-boggling what's going on. And I think panic just breeds more panic. And for the average person on the street that's hearing about all of this, it all of a sudden gives flashbacks to the financial crisis in 2007, 2008, in which, you know, a lot of people got burnt, a lot of people were scarred from still. And when money news starts to hit the front pages, that's when people start to act and start to panic. When, you know, really the start of all this was Bank of England raising rates. They couldn't remain rock bottom forever. We've become very much accustomed in the last 10 years, especially, to very low interest borrowing, a diet of cheap lending. At the same time, we've seen house prices go up. A lot of people on rock bottom mortgage rates, for example, that are now coming into that kind of panic mode of, well, I was fixed at 1, 2, 2.5%, and now coming on to potentially 5, 5.5%. Things like that, when it actually starts to hit the pound in your pocket, as we always say, and you actually start to directly see these things unfold in front of your eyes, it starts to panic people. So on one hand, you know, we could talk about UK government bonds. For a lot of people, that will just go over their head. They've got absolutely no idea. It's going into the real intricacies of like the UK economy. But when you start saying to someone, your mortgage is going to be £300 a year more, £300 a month more, that's when people go, whoa, hold on. Okay, what is going on? And that's when people start to sort of more, you know, try and educate themselves on what's actually going on. And I think Simon explained it very well there, because it's a deeply complex scenario that we're currently in.
Simon?
I just wanted to say one thing on that, like what could they have done differently. I don't want to like re-go over the mini budget, because obviously we talked about that substantially last week. But on reflection, looking at it as the dust settled, like what could they have done differently? Obviously, the big thing is the 45p tax rate, the abolition of
this. Why was that such a big thing?
Okay, because...
It doesn't affect that many people.
It doesn't affect that many people. It's not actually that much money, and you are... But it's because it's perceived as you're cutting tax for rich people, right? You're cutting tax for high earners. And it managed to completely overshadow the basic rate tax cut. So everybody came away from that talking about, well, I don't know if I agree with this whole cutting tax for rich people thing. And they're not talking about the cutting tax for everybody thing. And I've had a number of conversations with people not in the financial world over the past week, and that's emerged as the thing that they took away from the mini budget is, well, I don't know about this whole cutting tax for rich people. I don't really. And one of the comments that then follows it up is quite often, I don't see how that's really going to help everyone. I mean, they're not going to spend the money, are they? So people aren't convinced by the idea of the trickle down effect of rich people spending the money. And actually, in all honesty, if you cut tax for people earning 150, 200, 250 grand a year, they do tend to just invest the money left over. So I don't think they needed to do that. They could have waited for a budget and maybe announce the 19p now, wait for a budget for the 45p. You don't need to do that. I don't think they needed to even do half of the things they did. I think they could have just confirmed the energy bill support and then said, we are going to deliver plans to cut taxes, boost growth, do some other stuff, announce some kind of growth stuff, and then hold it for either an autumn statement, which would have been November time, right? They're not going to have to wait that long, or hold it for a budget. I don't know. I don't think they needed to rush it out. And I definitely don't think they needed to rush the 45p tax thing out. And as I said last week, I don't really have a problem with cutting the 45p tax rate. Letting people keep more of the money that they earn is a good thing. I have a problem with it when you have a scenario where people who have child benefit taken off them between 50 and 60,000 pounds, people who have their personal allowance taken off them over 100,000 pounds, actually pay a far higher tax rate on the next pound they earned than the people further up the scale. But I do think it's worth noting that whilst the 50p, the removing the 45p tax rate does save, you know, people who are earning a lot, quite a bit of money, by the time you get to £150,000, by the time you even reach the threshold, you've paid about £50,000 in income tax. Mm. That is a lot, right? Okay. And it, by the time you get to, say, for example, £250,000, you've paid 40% tax. Even once you remove that 45p, you've paid 40% tax on £200,000 of your earnings. So that's like 80 grand's worth of tax. That is a lot, you know. So that's one of the arguments for doing it. But why they decided to announce that, I don't know. And it has coloured the answers to it. And even the IMF mentioned it. But, you know, to be honest, I don't think they're going to be particularly concerned about the IMF, because the IMF represents the orthodoxy that we're trying to shake ourselves free from as we go for growth. Yeah. So
I do think, politically speaking, it was sort of gifting on a silver platter ahead of a Labour Party conference, you know, bankers' bonuses and 45% tax. Lee, you mentioned there about what the average person on the street, as it were, basically anyone whose job is not an economist, would be thinking of this. I want to get your advice a little bit later on about what we can do about the money. But just in the loosest terms, what does things like falling pound mean for my mum, for example? Gilt yields, the mortgages are pretty obvious, but, you know, explain to me what all of this might mean for the average person on the street's money.
Well, there's lots of factors at play, and there's lots of, we always say on this podcast, but there's no one size fits all. Everything financially hits people in different ways, right? But in terms of a falling pound, we saw it drop to a record low against the dollar on Monday. It's recovered some ground since. But that, again, is sort of panic stage, isn't it? When you see historic low pound against the dollar. And I think immediately, first thing people think about is, oh, it just makes it expensive to go on holiday to America. I remember when it was $2 to a pound. And that's a conversation that I've had with numerous people this week, because that's what people kind of think about first. But let's face it, how often do we go on holiday to the US? You know, it's not an everyday kind of essential thing. But what we do see is a lot of things, a lot of everyday things are priced in dollars. Commodities, you know, coffee, chocolate, bananas, all of these kind of things are priced in dollars. And if the dollar continues to strengthen against the pound, those things become more expensive. And we're already in a cost of living crisis in which we have seen food inflation soaring, for example. Something like 50% of all of our food produce is imported, and that becomes more expensive. A lot of it is priced in dollars. Dollars has become almost the de facto global currency. You know, that's the thing, that's, people are used to it. So it does make things in that regard more expensive. But to be honest, a lot of that has already been exacerbated by inflation. We were closing in on back on double digit inflation, aren't we? We're 9.9%, and people are feeling that in their everyday life. So there's lots of things at play. One thing I will say that I was found quite interesting was, I was chatting to someone this week, and do you remember last year, and I'm talking about importers here, remember last year when we were talking about the port chaos and how basically a container was costing anywhere between $15,000 and $20,000 to get shipped in, up from like $2,000 before the pandemic? Well, they told me actually, quite interestingly, that their freight costs now dropped to $4,000 a container compared to last year. So actually, it was quite a massive drop. And the weakening pound against the dollar, everything that they buy is priced in dollars, was being completely sort of, it wasn't as bad as the container prices. But that's it. That's importers. That's an importers kind of thing. And people might have different experiences of that. But I thought that was quite interesting. But, you know, it just makes things that little bit more expensive. And then talking about things like petrol, you know, we've seen the price of oil fall. Oil is, of course, priced in dollars. So that means that, you know, again, where we're seeing prices fall, prices are getting wiped back on by these the strengthening dollar. And it's the same with gas prices. I mean, gas prices are incredibly volatile. And as we've seen this year, if you'd said to me this time last year, everyone was going to be an expert on gas prices and how your energy bill works, then, you know, I would have been like, what? Why? But now people are. And the strengthening dollar doesn't help in that regard either. When it comes to, we're now coming into winter, I put the heating on for the first time this morning, and that's where people start to feel it the most.
Before we get on to the what we can do about it going forward, Simon, mortgages. I mean, I know it only affects about a third of people who've got mortgages, but what happened there? Just explain to us a bit of an economics 101, you know, why it occurred, and will homes be repossessed?
Well, to answer your second question, if people don't keep up with their mortgage payments, then their home is at risk of being repossessed, as the warning says at the bottom of every mortgage ad you've ever seen in your life. I mean, I don't know what the banks and building societies are going to do about this when they start to find arrears go up, and they will find arrears go up, because the amount of money extra that people are going to have to be paying on their mortgage is quite substantial. To a certain degree, we are protected from this by fixed rate mortgages, because most mortgages are fixed. The vast majority of mortgages that are taken out nowadays are fixed. And actually, I mean, I think it's more than half of those fixed rates are now for 5-year fixes. So people are protected. But when they come to the end of those fixed rates, they are going to see their rates rise dramatically. To put this into context, we have a generation of homeowners who have bought homes. They've borrowed money to do so on low rates. Every time they've remortgaged, the rate has gone down rather than up. And they have been assured by central bankers, by central bankers themselves, in the whole forward guidance era, that when rates rose, it would be gently and gradually. That hasn't been the case. In fact, rate rises have been brutal and swift, which is literally the opposite of gentle and gradual. And we have seen the base rate go from 0.1% in December to 2.25% now. Fixed rate mortgages have gone up hugely. To put this in context, at the start of the year, Nationwide had a 5-year fixed rate mortgage at 1.49%. After its repricing this week, Britain's biggest building society's 5-year fixes start at 5.19%. On a £250,000 mortgage over 25 years, you're paying £999 a month and £1,489, aka £490 difference. That is immense. That's about £6,000 a year more that someone has to find. And people are facing that degree of payment shock. The problem is that whilst lots of people don't face it immediately, people have to remortgage. Their fixed rate deals come to an end. There are people whose fixed rate deals are coming to an end in the next 3 to 6 months, and they are absolutely thrown into a tailspin at the moment, because the rise in mortgage rates has accelerated dramatically since Friday. Basically, we have seen lender after lender after lender say, we're not taking any more new business, in order to basically protect themselves, A, financially, from suddenly writing a load of rates at mortgages that are cheaper, and then you get an emergency rate hike and all of a sudden rates are higher, but also to protect themselves from like sudden influxes of business that they just can't deal with, in order to protect themselves there. So you've seen this dramatic escalation. You've seen people literally panicking, what do I do? And it's going to get, and they can't just sit tight, because whilst it might be okay, well, this usually when the fear gauge is cranked up to 11, it's the worst possible time to do anything. This might be the worst time to be looking for a mortgage, because everyone's freaking out. But at the same time, we've now got predictions that base rate might have to go up to 6.25%. Mm-hmm. So that's only going to make things worse. So we've thrown a lot of people into a very, very difficult scenario. As I wrote in my column this week, this is going to dramatically increase intergenerational inequality, because it is homeowners in their 40s, 30s and 20s that are going to pay the price for this, because they're the ones with the big mortgages that they've had to take out to deal with high house prices. And they've been assured by lots of people in the financial industry not to worry about that chart that shows the house prices to wages ratio that we bang on about all the time, because their monthly payments are low and interest rates are low. But you know what? Interest rates aren't low anymore. And once they have to remortgage, those monthly payments aren't going to be low either. And this is a genuine problem. And I don't know what we're going to do about it.
Lee, I said it's only going to affect a third of people's mortgages. That's not true, because about a third of people are renters. And I imagine this could affect them too.
Yeah, well, there's been what's been happening in the residential mortgage market has been happening in the buy-to-let market as well. And actually, buy-to-let rates, mortgage rates tend to be quite a bit higher than residential rates. So if a landlord is having to remortgage or take out a new product at a higher rate than before, then the likelihood is that they're going to filter that through into rental prices. And let's face it, we've been talking about this on the podcast throughout this year. The cost of rents have been going up anyway. So this could be another reason for rents to go up, which puts strain again onto renters. So there's lots of factors at play. There's people that actually, we started to see that 5-year fixed rate mortgages were becoming more popular than 2-year fixed rate mortgages. And actually, really interestingly, when I was in the office this week with Simon, Simon had dug through his email inbox from this time last year. And there was a press release about the number of sub 1% mortgages was at a all-time high. So there are people that have managed to get themselves onto a 5-year fix, which will take them through to 2026, potentially on a 1 or 1.5% mortgage rate. What happens that far down the road? Who knows? But we are talking in the short term. Experts are saying that a base rate could be 6%, sort of middle of next year. What does that then do to mortgage rates? And we have seen house prices obviously going up pretty rapidly since that stamp duty holiday that was in the pandemic. Which is there going to be the big question on everyone's lips as well, is there going to be some sort of massive house price correction? You know, will we now see property prices fall 10-15% potentially next year? Well, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not going to start making predictions. Mm-hmm. I've got no idea. But house prices are up something like 20% in the last 18 months or so. So there are all of these things at play. But if it starts to become way more expensive for people to pay their mortgage, that is worrying times, on top of energy bills that are probably, even with the intervention, are likely to be at least double what people are used to paying. That's a lot of extra monthly outlay for people. And yeah, I mean, there's people that have borrowed quite a lot of money compared to their salary to get onto the property ladder. And I think that's where the real issue lie, whether or not they could afford this kind of big rise in their mortgage payment. And could they afford this kind of big rise in their mortgage payment if their house price doesn't grow in the next couple of years and they don't qualify for a lower LTV and all of those kind of things? We were talking about this, George. Do you remember? I honestly was thinking about this in the office the other day. A good 3 or 4 months ago, I felt like we were starting to talk about how potentially down the road we might be facing mortgage rates going up a fair amount. And I felt like I was being a bit too doom-mongery, but I've realised that I undercooked it. It's been absolute madness. I think the one thing you can definitely say is, between sort of start of this year till now, these have been very sharp, fast rises. I think it's kind of taken the majority of people by surprise to be facing up to the potential cheapest mortgages being 5 or 5.5% compared to your ones and twos and 2.5s. It's quite a big jump. And then if we're talking about 6% base rate at some point next year, and we're currently on 2.25%, I mean, that is a recipe for potential, you know, worry down the road. And actually, quite a lot of mortgage lenders will allow you to remortgage and pick a deal up 6 months in advance. It's worth not burying your head in the sand. If you're listening to this and that's you, it's worth contacting your lender, find out your options, potentially a broker, and seeing what you could do now. Because the likelihood is, again, I don't like making predictions, but base rate, I think we can safely say, is going to keep heading higher for a little bit of time yet.
Simon?
Looking at that mortgage issue, I said in my column that this week that there'll be many people reading it who remember the property pain of the early 1990s and dismiss complaints about 5% mortgage rates with a wry look, because they had double-digit interest rates. And the impact then was immediate of those interest rate hikes, because most mortgages weren't fixed. They just went up and up and up and up and up. And the 90s property crash was devastating for people. You know, for some people never financially never came back from it. You know, it affected their whole lives. Yet, if you take into account the fact that house prices were lower compared to wages then, and you adjust the kind of pain index for affordability, then much lower interest rates are needed to bring the same level of pain now. There's a really good affordability adjusted rates chart that Sky's Ed Conway did, based on research by a guy called Neil Hudson from Built Place, which illustrates that point. And I've linked to it in my column and put it into my column. And it shows that nowadays rates of about 6% would bring a similar mortgage burden to those double digit rates of the early 1990s. And that illustrates the severity of the scenario that we are in.
Right. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North from eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Well, Sam, that was quite an eventful week, wasn't it? What's your take on it all?
Yeah, if ever a week felt like a year, it was this one. And right from the get-go, things kicked off overnight in Asian trade on Monday or Sunday night, whichever way you want to think about it. The pound against the dollar hit its lowest level ever in a flash crash, which made, at its worst, the pound down 25% on the year. Remarkably, it did recover and it's actually set to finish the week higher than where it started, which is quite baffling all in all. The Bank of England confirming it was planning up to £65 billion worth of new quantitative easing. It calmed the markets a little bit, but the volatility was evident the whole week in the currency, the equity and the bond space for the UK. We've also this week seen how high inflation is in Germany, near 11%, in Europe, 10%. Which will pretty much seal a deal for a 75 basis point hike at their next meeting. All in all, as well, obviously September's done, the quarter's done, it's been brutal. Only the dollar has returned positive.
So let's catch our breath. At the moment, I would say it's really hard to predict what's going to happen in the next hour, let alone what's going to happen the week ahead. But what are your thoughts? Is it going to be more settled, or is it going to be more volatility as October starts?
Yeah, I mean, literally until the markets close, anything can happen. New week will be obviously a new month and a new quarter. So we've got to all cross our fingers that it won't be as bad as September. In terms of things to keep an eye on next week, we've got some US data, which will potentially move the markets and therefore change expectations for the next Federal Reserve meeting. So we've got the US job numbers next Friday. That'll be the main event as we look to see how the labour market is holding up. We also have minutes from the last ECB meeting, and we've got Reserve Bank of Australia rate decision too. So central banks will be in focus. Dare I say it, other than that, it's relatively quiet on a data front. Obviously, the market won't be quiet, but fingers crossed. I mean, earnings-wise, there's a couple to keep an eye on as well, but really, that doesn't kick off for 2 weeks. So maybe we can just cross our fingers and all will be well, but I don't think that's going to happen in 2022, is it?
Thank you very much. Sam North from eToro.
Thank you, Lee.
Welcome back. So, Simon, the Bank of England stepped in. A U-turn, was it then, for quantitative tightening, shaking the magic money tree? Interesting, because I was under the impression that Liz Truss, throughout her leadership campaign, wasn't a big fan of this sort of manoeuvre, but it seems like the Bank of England stepped in and rather, I don't know, saved the day for her. I mean,
the Bank of England is independent.
Obviously,
I'm independently, quite surprised having said that. It's a strong institution that acts independently, and it stepped in to deal with a particular piece of market dysfunction. Whether you can isolate that particular piece of market dysfunction from Friday's events is up to you to decide. And you've listened to the podcast this far, and we've talked about all of that. So make your own mind up on that. The ministers are out at the moment telling people that the two aren't directly related and that the Bank of England didn't have to step in because of what happened on Friday. So that's the government's line. I think it's fair to give them that kind of, you know, right of reply there. The question is the Bank of England's action enough to deliver two things? One, stability in the markets. Has it stepped in to the degree, and will this action be enough to stop gilt yields spiraling particularly those 30-year long-dated gilt yields that were causing the big problems. But also, I think, you know, with the stuff that's causing issues with the mortgage market, the shorter dated ones, the twos, the fives, the tens, right? Can they get some stability into the gilt market? And the idea is that by becoming a major buyer of gilts, the Bank of England increases demand. The concern in the market is that there is not enough demand for gilts, and there's going to be an awful lot more supply of them. And so people are asking higher interest rates in order to hold UK government debt. And gilts are issued with a face value, and then they pay a certain amount of interest, known as the coupon. But on the secondary market, they can trade above or below their face value. And if they are trading at below their face value, i.e. the price goes down, then the yield goes up. Because effectively, for example, if you've got a bond with £1,000 face value and it promises to pay 2% interest, that's £20 a year. If that bond is so out of favor that it's trading at half its face value at £500, well, the yield on that is now 4%, because you are buying £20 worth of income for only £500. And that is a 4% return on your £500. So yields move around all the time. What you need to worry about is when the direction suddenly starts to become rapid and seriously one way. And has the Bank of England managed to stall that? Hopefully, and remove the selling pressure. The other question is, will it get it through to November and its interest rate decision, or will it have to bring in an emergency interest rate rise? And the thoughts of an emergency, a sudden large emergency interest rate rise, are also deeply unsettling the financial markets and triggered the sort of first wave of chaos in the mortgage market here. Can we do those two things, basically?
Isn't this sort of move from the Bank of England one that you might expect, I don't know, global pandemic, some sort of energy crisis, global big issue? Are we talking on that scale where we're going through at the minute?
It's highly unusual. We don't see this kind of stuff very often. I mean, I've been doing this gig for nearly two decades and I've not seen that many of these. But
is it a reflection of the scale of what and perhaps the longevity of what could happen here? Yeah. I mean, I'm not suggesting that what we're seeing at the moment on the markets, the pound, the mortgages, all this sort of thing is, you know, this sort of flash in the pan, bad moment, and we'll all kind of carry on as per afterwards. But, you know, is there an element of hyperbole about this? Are we in this massive crisis? Because this would suggest this sort of action that we really are.
Well, it's not. It's a localized crisis at the moment and affecting, you know, the UK. It's not like the global financial crisis that was affecting everywhere and banks. And also,
we are seeing threats of global recession, aren't we, around the world? We're seeing issues with mortgages again, yes, all around the world.
Yeah. Yes, we are. And, you know, the bigger picture here is that this is still the after effects of the pandemic. The inflation spike is still, you know, started in the after effects of the disruption of the pandemic and the lockdowns that were brought in to deal with the pandemic that happened all around the world. And I mean, particularly even in China still, you know, now that has been happening. Then there was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which has caused, you know, an energy price spike and massively disrupted energy markets, at the same time as, due to the transition towards greener energy, we've stopped using coal and become more reliant on gas to try and tide us through while we try to get through to more renewable energy. And then also the bigger picture than that is that we are at the point where the low interest rate environment world that we had all become so used to, super, super low interest rates, very, very loose monetary policy, a real desire not to do anything to tighten, and a situation where it was deflation that was concerned, not inflation, and nobody thought inflation was going to come back. Post-financial crisis is being unwound. There has been a change. We talked about this so many times this year. There's been a change in the mood music. Okay, it's totally changed the whole attitude to it. So you put all of those things together, it's easy to see how you could trip up, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The thing you have to do if you trip up is you have to bring back some kind of stability and trust. And trust is hard to earn and easy to squander. So you have to be very, very careful there. But as I said earlier, these things are done now, right? It's the what do we do now? How do we move on? I think we're just going to have to chalk this one up to experience and maybe decide that let's not do that again without it being in a proper budget and properly costed and all that kind of stuff.
Lee, Simon making a very good point there about trust. With that in mind, what should Liz Truss, Kwasi Kwarteng, be doing right now?
I probably wouldn't be bunkering down and sort of like hiding out a bit. I mean, it felt a little bit this week that this has been going on and it's been a bit of a wall of silence, which I'm not sure was it on purpose to kind of not make things worse or what it was really. But I think that it seems like they're very firm on this. It seems like the lady won't be for turning. So it seems like these cuts are here to stay, but who knows? As we've said throughout the show, it just happened, just really did just blindside people for one, and not having the proper costings for two. I think it's just spooked people. And then when we've got another statement coming in November, which as Simon has said,
shouldn't they just bring that forward? Because that's the one that's supposed to have all the detail in it. We've got, you know, the OBR taking a look at it apparently, that, but this is not for months, just, you know, do on Monday or something.
But perhaps this is part of the cause of all this sort of, you know, mini meltdown that's happened, is the fact that actually have they costed this all through properly? It takes time, you know, to properly work this all out. And it feels like it's been quite rushed through. I mean, the Conservative leadership contest felt like it took an absolute lifetime.
Well, there you go. They had all that time to sort it out, didn't they? And well, anyone that thinks this was a surprise, surely this is Trussonomics in action, no?
Yeah, but the way it's been done and the way it's been delivered so quickly, I think it just has spooked people. Kind of like it's a little bit erratic, it feels like, and it highlights actually just quite how fragile the economy can be, and how many moving parts there are and how many levers there are to pull and how things that kind of do come out of the blue can rock markets and can filter through to all different elements of the economy.
So with that regard then, I mean, economically speaking, there were perhaps some errors made, but actually this was quite a big political error. I think perhaps they were so desperate to move away from the past regime and to stamp their authority very quickly, very hard. And actually they sort of mistimed it in the context of, you know, the wider global events. Is that sort of a fair assessment?
Well, let's face it, it's been a highly unusual few years since the general election in 2019, which actually does feel like a complete and utter lifetime ago, right? But we're talking not even quite 3 years ago. And obviously we've had the pandemic. That's done all sorts of strange things to the economy. And you know, it felt like we kind of held it all together. There was lots of rescue packages. There was a lot of money, a lot of borrowing, a lot of stuff going on to get us through all of that. And then it just feels like there's definite light at the end of the tunnel of the pandemic. I mean, the pandemic now almost feels like a lifetime ago. Is it over? I mean, it's hard to really say, but it's been completely knocked out of the news cycle for one. And then we've come on to this kind of, Liz Truss has not got long to try and make her mark, as I'm saying. And it's kind of, I guess the kind of thought process for her was, if I wait until November, is it going to be too late to reveal, you know, what was my kind of policy and what's got me, you know, made me win the Conservative leadership contest, big tax cuts. That was kind of, you know, the big agenda. So in a way, you're right. You know, was it a shock that this happened? I think it's just the way it was delivered. I mean, a Friday morning, highly unusual. But then I don't know if anything is normal anymore anyway.
What no, right.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Simon, though,
would things have been different if it was Rishi Sunak?
Oh, Lee, you've just anticipated my question. I was going to say, Simon, the $1 billion question, or the $72 billion question, whatever, is would Rishi have done it better?
One of the key points that he made in his leadership campaign was stressing the need to be prudent and the fact that we couldn't just keep running up the tab forever. And I think he has been proved to be right in that sense. I guess the better question is, could Rishi have got away with delivering that mini budget? Maybe he could have done. I mean, as I said, I don't necessarily think the concept of going for growth is such a bad one. And he would have got a, well, what is he playing at here? But he's got the experience. He's seen as a firm hand on the tiller. I still think it would have been an issue to deliver it as a fiscal statement rather than as a budget or a proper, mini budget as in an autumn or spring statement. But I think maybe, he might have had a bit more faith in it. And it is not Kwasi Kwarteng's fault that he's only just become chancellor. He's doing his job, but it does help if you're going to deliver that kind of, sort of blast of stuff if you've got the track record.
Yeah. Penny for Rishi's thoughts after that. Just a quick one though, Simon. Conservative Party, the party of fiscal responsibility or good housekeeping, as I believe Margaret Thatcher always used to call it. A Labour Party now, the party of fiscal responsibility. We had Keir Starmer making a speech. That seemed to have gone down well. Really anything can go down well after what we've just seen. But your thoughts? I know we're not a political podcast, but in terms of fiscal.
No, I'm not. And I'm totally apolitical. I hold politicians of all hue in the same level of level of respect and disdain. I make no difference between them. If somebody's got a good idea, they've got a good idea. I don't know. I mean, look, come on a minute. Hang on a minute. It wasn't that long ago we had Jeremy Corbyn trying to become prime minister. And so on and so on. I mean, look, the whole thing's is a big mess. And there aren't many people who've been speaking out on this scenario over the years saying, look, this is just completely unsustainable and we need to do something about this because one day the reckoning is going to come and interest rates are going to go up and inflation is going to spike. So there hasn't been any of those people. And I think that actually the people who are currently facing remortgaging off rates at 1.5-2% onto 5% plus, or really fearing for the fact that their bills are going to go up and they can't afford their bills, who have seen their energy bills spike through no fault of their own, through our complete failure to have like any form of energy security in this country. But I think with the mortgage thing, I think those people are owed a big apology by the banks, the building societies, the financial industry, the politicians, all the people who kept telling them not to worry about high house prices compared to wages, because it was okay, interest rates were low, and when interest rates went up, they would go up gradually and gently because they believed them. You take personal responsibility in this scenario and you don't overstretch yourself, but there's not overstretching yourself and then suddenly seeing your mortgage payments go up by £6,000 a year when you thought that you were doing the sensible thing and you'd been told one thing and then another thing happened. The question is, more importantly for those people, what do they do now? And the first answer is, don't panic.
Well, I will get Lee to say that, but I just have to say, Simon, I'd vote for you because that was brilliant, kind of like swiftly diverting, not going to answer the question, but I'm going to say what people really want to listen to. And you're absolutely right. People do want to listen to that rather than political posturing at the moment. Lee Boyce, now is your moment. There's a lot of things that people are worried about. So it's your responsibility to reassure everyone and tell us what to do. Mortgages are a first step. What should you be considering now, if you're a first-time buyer, you're remortgaging, whatever?
Well, I can only reiterate what Simon just said there. Number one is just don't panic, right? Because a panic, as I said earlier, leads to more panic. Now, if you are someone that is set to remortgage, now, there's lots of people, majority of people with mortgages are on fixed rates. As I said earlier in the show, you potentially can lock in a rate 6 months. If rates for some reason fell between that 6 month period, you could potentially get a different deal. But it's almost like a security blanket of locking in something now you don't necessarily have to take in 6 months time. Not all lenders let you do that. I'm not saying that absolutely every single bank, building society or specialist lender will let you do that, but quite a few will. And it really is a kind of weekend to take stock of where you're at with your mortgage, what rate you're currently paying, when it comes up for renewal, how much you're chipping away at the moment, and what a potential higher rate would mean for you. It doesn't take long to work all of that kind of thing out. I've heard a lot of people have been asking me about potentially overpaying the mortgage. There's lots of pros and cons about that. Now, the theory is you overpay your mortgage a bit. Usually lenders, again, just as a rule of thumb, will let you overpay 10%, and you can chip away at your mortgage a little bit, paying a little bit more than you have to, and that will knock off some of the interest and potentially some of the term. The thing is, and this is why it's quite worth considering now, more so than probably this time last year, to do your homework on this, is the fact that you can now get savings products, you know, above 4%, which potentially it might be better off just to be building up a pot of cash somewhere else that could then potentially be used, if you want to later down the line, to pay off a bit of extra of your mortgage when you come to renew. So you need to factor all of those things in when you're thinking about it. But I would just say, don't panic, stay on course. There's a lot of nervy, I mean, buying your first home is a nervy experience anyway. I remember when I bought my first home 6 years ago, which I currently still live in, and the panic was real, thinking about, am I overpaying for this? It's a lot of money. You might not ever see that money, and it's all just numbers on the screen, but it's still a panic-inducing experience when you're paying six figures for something and you're on the hook for that debt until it's paid off. You know, will there be a property price crash? I remember thinking that 5-6 years ago, and you know, but you'd end up never doing anything if you just sat around and panicked all the time. And a lot of people that are currently buying their first homes, it could be a long process. I mean, buying this place took me 9 months. 9 months ago, the mortgage market looked completely different, and I had a mortgage all sorted out in advance. So there's a lot of people that are in that position. It feels like one of those things that's going to be a little bit later down the line.
Simon, pensions and investments, what should we be thinking about here? I suppose it depends for pensions on your age. Also investments, any bargains to be had?
I think the first thing with your pension is that you need to not panic again. The stories that people are reading about pension fund potential collapses and the Bank of England stepping in are to do with defined benefit pension schemes. Those are the ones where your employer promises to pay you a percentage of your salary for every year that you work there, and they are legally committed to do so, and your pension is protected by the pensions lifeboat. And we have seen instances where pension funds have collapsed and people have lost some of the pension that they would have been owed, but many of them have all, if they're already in retirement, your pension is protected, but some people who aren't in retirement yet have lost some of the money that they would have got, but the vast bulk of it is protected and you have a far better deal than people in defined contribution pensions. Those are the ones where you put some money in and your employer puts some money in and then your money is invested. Now, for those people, the question is, what's going to happen to the investments that they hold? And they've already seen a lot of pain this year. They're not really seeing a huge fallout at the moment from the stuff that's been going on over the past week. In fact, they're seeing more pain from the fact that the S&P 500 index over in the US is down 20 to 25% this year. A lot of people will be invested in big global tracker funds there. So, you know, they feel the pain of the global markets. You do end up with this kind of UK bias with a lot of investments. But in theory, actually, if you go back to the investment question, the falling pound can be good for the FTSE because there's lots of very big companies that dominate the FTSE 100 and also the FTSE All Share Index. And they earn a lot of money from overseas. And the money that they're earning from overseas when the pound falls translates into more profits in pounds. And more profits in pounds leads to investors more highly rating those shares. I mean, even though those pounds are worth less than they were before, but, you know, let's not go too deep into that. I think there is an issue for people who perhaps had moved their investments towards what are judged to be safe assets, i.e. government bonds, in the approach to retirement because they thought they were then going to buy an annuity. But that kind of investment style has waned somewhat in recent years because most people now keep their pensions invested in retirement in order to draw on them. So there's not the same cliff edge where you need to get your money as safe as possible because then you're going to go buy an annuity. Now, the flip side of all of this, of course, is that annuity rates have increased dramatically and improved dramatically from where they once were. So you're starting to look at the point where people in retirement who want a secure income for the rest of their lives might be considering now buying an annuity with their pot again, because the rates that they're going to get are much better, and that's going to translate into thousands of pounds more in terms of retirement income. But then you've also got the scenario where if they think rates are going to keep going up, maybe if they lock into an annuity now, they're giving up on getting an even better annuity in months to come. So it's quite a difficult one. If anybody is in that position and isn't really sure what to do, I would speak to a financial advisor. I think at retirement and approaching retirement is a really good time to get really good financial advice from people, because this is a point where it starts to, for many people, become too complex for them to make their own decisions. I think as an investor, you need to try to look through the short-term volatility and try to avoid panic selling. It's immensely difficult to time the markets. Most people usually get caught out on it, and that's why they manage to underperform the actual investments that they hold, because they chop and change. If you've got a long investment horizon, if you're just investing to get wealthier, if you're investing for a pension that's in 20, 30 years time, when you look back in years to come, the falls that we've seen this year, although substantial, will just look like a tiny blip on a chart that goes upwards. That said, the FTSE 100 has managed to once again fall back to the level that it ended the 1990s at, a label that is perennially put on the unluckiest major stock market index in the world. But you have to remember that although the share price level of the index has managed to go nowhere in 22 years, you have had a lot of return in dividends since then. And that's the thing that really drives long-term investment returns, dividends that are reinvested.
Thank you very much, Simon. Finally, Lee, just a quick one about travel money. Because if the pound is falling, it's not worth as much. Going to New York to buy your clothes, not quite as appealing as it perhaps once was some time ago. But don't settle, obviously, for going to the airport to get your travel money. What can you do?
Travel money-wise, actually, I was walking down the street the other day and the bureaus were offering sort of like pretty much a dollar for a pound. That ain't good. You don't want to be doing that. You need to go and lock in a rate online somewhere beforehand, order it in advance. Don't pay for it in advance, but order it in advance. You always usually get a better rate than you would if you just rock up. And also just make sure that you've got the right plastic in your wallet. I like to take a combination of both. When I went to New York earlier in the year, I like to have those dollars in my pocket. So I practice exactly what I preach. And I locked in my dollars, went and picked them up, got a much better rate. Then it's kind of nice as well, seeing that you're getting a better rate than if you had just gone and not done that simple step of ordering your currency. And the second thing is, I still have my Starling card, which is fee-free. What I really like about that is having the app. At the start of the year, just tucking in 100, 150 quid a month, knowing that that was going to be my spending money for the summer, and knowing that I'm getting a better rate. And when I'm taking out cash or paying for things while I'm there, there's no fees. So it is important to remember all of that kind of things, but all those kind of things. But I think at the moment where we're at, not many people are thinking about potential trips to America and all that kind of thing. What people really care about, Georgie, is savings and savings rates. Now, the reason why I say that, and I'm going to end this podcast in really sort of fashion in which it's going to get everyone really G'd up instead of it being doom and gloom. You know, we keep ending it and then I feel like I come away and I sort of sit in a dark room and I think, have I been too doom and gloom? I'm really sorry. I'm going to end it on a high here. Now, saving stories this week, I'm going to let you into a little This Is Money insider secret here, have been absolute traffic like winners, as in I think people have actually read more stories about savings rates this week than the real technical stuff that we've covered, because people really care. You know, set up the savings alert service a few weeks ago. It's surfing to 10,000 signups already. People want to know the latest savings news. They want to know the latest savings rates. We did a story earlier in the week about Yorkshire Building Society, has millions of members. It's now got an easy access rate, which is not quite an easy access rate, of 2.5%, as in you can access it a few times a year. And people really read about that and really cared about it. Yesterday we had a story up about how rates now pay up to 4.4%. Absolutely flying. People reading that, people want to know. Savings rates are going up at the highest rate than they have for a very long time. And to be able to now get sort of almost 4% on a 1-year fix and more than 4% on a 2-year fix is pretty big news. Okay, inflation's at 9.9%. That doesn't help. It's not great. But there's still lots of light at the end of the tunnel in terms of savings. We are finally, savers are finally getting a return. But most notably, and I think the biggest bit of savings news this week, National Savings and Investment, Treasury-backed bank. Now, for whatever reason, I'm not going to speculate, it looks like it wants to rake in a little bit more money. It looks like it wants to, potentially get billions of pounds more of savers' cash. It's made some massive moves this week. I saw this and I was like, this is actually really quite big. The underlying rate of it has gone up to 2.2%, which is pretty much on par with Best Buy easy access rate. Now, you're not going to get that rate. That is just the underlying rate. Lots of people will have premium bonds and earn 0% because they won't win any prizes. Other people will win £1 million top jackpot and completely skew that. But that underlying rate is an important benchmark to remember. It was only 1% in June. So it's now up to 2.2%. But I think the most interesting thing about this, and I think what actually hooks people into premium bonds more than anything else, is the thought of winning a prize that's sort of five figures or above. I mean, for me, I hold premium bonds with that kind of little sliver of kind of hope that I might win £1 million. And I'm still going to get my stake back if I want to take my money out anytime. I'm going to quickly tell you, £100,000. Previously, there was 10 prizes of £100,000. From the next draw, that's 18. £50,000 prizes, there was 20 in the last draw. That's going up to 35. And for 25 grand, there were 39 prizes in the last draw. That's going up to 72. Now, at the same time, they've cut out quite a lot of the £25 prizes. So it's going from 4.8 million £25 prizes to 3.5. I think that's really interesting. I think people don't really, it's nice to get those little wins or whatever, but a lot of people are in premium bonds because they want to think that they could be in a bit of a chance of winning £25,000 or more. And that's where it's really bumped up. This prize pot is going up by something like 76 million pounds in the next draw, up from like 130 or something like that. So that's quite a sizable leap. A lot of people interested in that. I'm going to predict that there's going to be quite a lot of money inflowing into premium bonds. It triggers people into going, do you know what? Let's do it. So here we go. That's my good bit of news for you.
Well done, Lee. I'm inspired. Don't know about anyone else. Absolutely. That's it for this week. Thank you both. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk or you can tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past. And I repeat, don't panic, okay? Don't panic. Whatever you do, people make bad decisions when they panic. There is no need to panic, okay? It's not that bad.
There you go. Listen to Uncle Simon. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.